harnessing the power of live bacteria to preserve perishables for millennia. The earliest record of fermentation dates back more than 8,000 years, and nearly every civilization since has included at least one fermented food in its culinary heritage. In Japan, there's natto. In Korea, kimchi. Germany loves its sauerkraut, as do I. And modern yogurt, now ubiquitous, holds on to its original Turkish name. While many believe probiotics are helpful because they take up domicile in the gut, the truth is that the vast majority of probiotics we consume are just transient visitors, offering friendly communication with our more permanent residents and our immune cells. Our immune systems work best in a state of happy harmony with our microbiota, and probiotics seem to foster this connection, essentially tuning the immune system on their journey south. Probiotics can also reinforce the precious gut barrier, plastering up any leaks in the tight junctions between our gut epithelial cells. This can prevent compounds like endotoxin from leaking into circulation, a major instigator of systemic inflammation. Both of these functions together help explain the anti-inflammatory effects demonstrated by probiotics. The downstream benefits are innumerable and support the observation that people who eat more fermented foods tend to have better health and quality of life. Just remember, taking a probiotic supplement alone will never fix the damage caused by a poor diet, but the current data does show that consuming probiotic-rich foods like kimchi, kombucha, and kefir can enhance the effects of a high-fiber, low-carbohydrate diet as described in this book. Though supplementation is not often necessary, it can't hurt, and it might help. In Chapter 12, I will explain how to pick a high-quality probiotic supplement should you choose to go that route. Before we close out this section on our glorious gut barrier, it's important to note that gluten isn't the only potential instigator of increased permeability. Here are some other factors that can lead to a more porous gut. Alcohol consumption. In healthy non-alcoholics, a single vodka binge dramatically increases endotoxin and pro-inflammatory cytokines in the blood. That's because alcohol has been shown to inflame and produce a more permeable gut, explaining in part the harm that chronic alcohol consumption confers on the liver and other organs. Fructose. When fructose is removed from the matrix of fiber and phytochemicals that is normally found in whole fruit, it can increase intestinal permeability. High fructose corn syrup or agave syrup, which are widely used to sweeten commercial beverages, may be particularly bad news. Chronic stress. Public speaking, a common stressor for many, has been shown to momentarily induce gut permeability in humans, pointing to a new mechanism through which chronic stress can harm our health. Excessive exercise. Endurance athletes may experience gut permeability due to the stress of sustained aerobic training. In Chapter 10, I'll share new research on exercise that renders those long, grueling cardio sessions totally unnecessary. Fat, when consumed together with sugar. In animal models, high-fat diets, which often include sugar, have been found to induce leaky gut and inflammation. Processed food additives. More on this in a moment. Any of these stimuli can facilitate the leakage of endotoxin into circulation, even if you're on a gluten-free diet. Conversely, various plant compounds such as quercetin, a polyphenol found in onions, capers, blueberries, and tea, as well as the amino acid L-glutamine, have been found to reduce gut permeability and promote better function of the gut lining. And fiber, that miraculous and underrated nutrient, may be the most important of all, through its effect on an important, albeit slimy structure called the mucosa. Our marvelous mucosa. Thankfully, the epithelial cell layer doesn't have to defend against our constant daily onslaught of toxic substances and microbes on its own. In between the epithelium and the trillions of microbial cells of the microbiome, there is a dynamic matrix of mucus known as the mucosa, which comprises a form of carbohydrate called mucin. This mucus is produced by the cells of the epithelium and is essentially where the rubber hits the road for the microbiome. Not only does it provide a soft hammock upon which the bacteria luxuriate, but the mucus itself acts as a demilitarized zone, a layer of protection for the epithelial cells. Keeping the mucus layer healthy and robust is a major mechanism through which we can minimize inflammation in the body and, likely, the brain. While the science around this is new and evolving, one surefire strategy is to ensure a steady flow of dietary prebiotic fiber. This fiber feeds the microbes that supply butyrate, which actually feeds the cells that create the mucus, thus reinforcing its protective abilities. Conversely, a low-fiber diet starves our gut bacteria, forcing them to actually consume the mucosal layer out of desperation. But I'm not a mouse. Whenever one discusses early-stage research inevitably conducted in animals prior to humans or when human studies are unethical or impractical, there's always the question of how well it would apply to humans in the real world. A perfect example of this paradox is that Alzheimer's disease has been cured in mice many times over, and yet the results have never translated to human trials. The truth is that mice don't get Alzheimer's disease in the wild, and scientists in these cases are working with an artificially induced Alzheimer's disease model, an imperfect simulation. On the other hand, basic cellular mechanisms are highly conserved by evolution, meaning that they differ minimally across species. The more basic the process, the further away from humans we can go and still see an accurate result. We can study cell division by looking at yeast, for example. We can study the way a human neuron works by looking at the nearly identical giant neuron of a squid. And we can study the development of the fetal brain by looking at fruit flies. These processes are so important that they differ very little from species to species, thus enhancing our confidence in the translation of the results. As we delve into the study of the intestinal lining, we can infer much from animal studies, as the cells lining and surrounding our guts are very similar in all mammals. Is it certain that industrial chemicals have the same effect in humans as they do in mice? It will be years before the human science is settled, but we must make our decisions about the foods we ingest today. Gluten is a good example of a protein that some people may be able to tolerate in small, infrequent doses, but that irritates the gut lining in the context of the Western diet, which is low in fiber and high in bread, pasta, and packaged products. Packaged foods are full of emulsifying agents, which are used to create tasty mixtures of otherwise insoluble foods and ensure a smooth texture. These are commonly found in salad dressing, ice cream, nut milk, coffee creamer, and other processed foods. In animal studies, adding even a small amount of emulsifiers to the diet caused a profound change in the gut microbiota, eroding the mucosa and reducing the average distance between gut bacteria and intestinal cells by more than half. It may be that a 1-2 punch is required to initiate an inflammatory process. First, the erosion of the gut's protective layer, and then a reaction within the gut lining. When the mucosa is compromised, gut bacteria, both the beneficial butyrate-producing ones as well as pathogens, are able to infiltrate our gut barrier. This can lead to inflammation of the gut as the normal bacterial inhabitants breach the mucosa and come too close for comfort to our own immune system. In the emulsifier study I just mentioned, this is exactly what happened to the animals. The critical new insight here is that it may not simply be certain proteins, for example, gluten or lectins, another class of plant protein that has caused a stir lately, that caused this gut breakdown and inflammation in so many people. Rather, the very act of consuming industrially processed foods, those that have been stripped of fiber and made with agents like emulsifiers to create a smooth mouthfeel, can independently alter our microbiomes, strip our mucus linings, and make more of us vulnerable to the effects of those proteins. We breed what we feed. The gut microbiome is like an actual city in that there are at least 1,000 different species living in an immensely complex and highly competitive environment. There are beneficial short-chain fatty acid and butyrate-producing bacterial species, and there are problematic bacterial species, including potential pathogens, bacteria that might actually make you sick, that are kept under control by the community at large. The potent power of probiotics. Ready for a paradigm shift? Some very interesting studies have emerged recently highlighting the value that probiotics, foods or supplements rich in live bacteria, may hold for those of us suffering from depression, anxiety, and even dementia. In a small study from Holland's Leiden Institute for Brain and Cognition, women who took a probiotic supplement designed to enhance gut bacterial diversity experienced less reactivity to sad thoughts than those who took a placebo. Resilience to sad thoughts is a sign of strong mental health. For example, in depressed people, a sad stimulus can turn an otherwise spotless sky into an overcast day, whereas someone with a healthy mood can simply observe the sad thought and move on without significant cloud formation. Can consuming more fermented foods like kombucha, yogurt, sauerkraut, and kimchi help our anxiety? Maybe, according to another study that found that students who consumed more of these types of foods had less social anxiety. The effect was especially strong in those who had neurotic personalities. It is likely that the probiotics in the fermented foods are favorably changing the environment in the gut, and changes in the gut in turn influence social anxiety, wrote one of the authors in the College of William and Mary and University of Maryland study. Groundbreaking research out of Iran suggests that probiotics may even boost cognitive function in one particularly desperate group, patients with advanced Alzheimer's. The researchers put severely demented patients on a 12-week high-dose cocktail of lactobacillus and bifidobacterium, two common strains of probiotics, and found that, compared to the control group who received only a placebo, the probiotic group improved on a test of cognitive function by an astonishing 30%. Though the effect would need to be replicated with a larger sample size, these preliminary results are certainly cause for hope. Scientists have truly just scratched the surface on what will be a fascinating decade to come in microbiome research as the broad reach of probiotics comes into view. Certain strains may help fight off certain cancers, boost heart health, enhance brain neurogenesis, and even alter mood states, the latter paving the way for psychobiotics. More on this in Chapter 8. The two reigning bacterial families found in the large intestine are the Bacteroidetes and Firmicutes. They're sort of like the Montagues and the Capulets if Romeo and Juliet took place in your large intestine. Though there is currently no consensus on what the perfect microbial composition looks like, there are correlates that scientists can draw by observing the microbial signature of various populations with different health profiles. For example, some research has suggested that overweight people have more Firmicutes than Bacteroidetes, or Capulets than Montagues in our Shakespeare analogy. At this point, it's unknown whether this or any other signature is causally related to, or merely reflective of, the health of its human host. However, animal studies using fecal microbial transplants are paving a road toward greater clarity. With this method, we're able to answer the question, can we change aspects of an animal's health and appearance by changing its microbiome? In one such example, scientists wanted to see what would happen if they transplanted the microbiomes of obese mice with insulin resistance into the digestive tracts of lean mice. As if by magic, the lean mice, when given the obese mice's microbes, began to gain weight, displaying the same metabolic dysfunction as their obese counterparts. While humans are more complex than mice, this study does suggest that microbes in many ways call the shots, at least where our weight is concerned. But what about our mental health and cognition? For the first time, groundbreaking research illustrated a link between brain structure and function and gut bacteria in healthy humans. In this UCLA study, healthy women had their microbiome sequenced and brains scanned and were given a test that assesses risk for depression. Those women with a higher proportion of Prevotella, a type of bacteria, in their guts had heightened connectivity between emotional and sensory brain regions while having smaller and less active memory centers. When they were shown negative imagery, these women seemed to experience stronger emotions, as if they were distressed. On the other hand, women with a higher proportion of Bacteroides, another common type of gut bacteria, were much less likely to experience negative emotions when shown the same images. Structurally, their memory centers were larger, and they also had more volume in their prefrontal cortexes, which is the hub of executive function. It seemed as if the women with less Prevotella and more Bacteroides were emotionally stronger and more resilient. Were the bacteria affecting the women's brains, or were the women's brains somehow altering the mixture of bacteria in the gut? No one knows. However, as they have done with metabolism and weight, scientists have been able to alter mouse behavior and what could be interpreted as mouse mental health just by tinkering with their microbiomes, suggesting that the types of bacteria present in the gut do play a role in brain function. As I've mentioned, the optimal gut makeup is a puzzle that is a long way from being solved, and it is likely to be different for you than it is for me. It is interesting to note, however, that people who consume carbohydrate-rich, grain-based diets tend to have higher proportions of Prevotella bacteria residing in their guts. Many scientists in the field seem to agree that the best way to ensure that the beneficial bacteria maintain a competitive edge in the tough and constantly changing colonic environment is to consume a diet that is rich in fiber and plant nutrients such as polyphenols, and to avoid sugar and refined carbohydrates. This pattern will directly benefit the helpful microbiota and will starve out the pathogens, making it difficult for more malevolent species to gain a foothold in the rough-and-tumble gut ecosystem. As we await further clarity, trading a grain-based diet in for one built on prebiotic fiber-rich vegetables seems like a safe bet toward shifting your microbiome and mood to a healthier state. Frequently asked question: but whole grains contain fiber. Shouldn't I eat more of them? Answer: whole grains contain very small amounts of prebiotic fiber. The fiber content of grains is mainly insoluble fiber, and where your microbiome is concerned, all fiber is not created equal. Insoluble fiber is not prebiotic and is unable to be metabolized by gut bacteria. It's basically sawdust. Grains also provide a large amount of starch, which is essentially pure glucose. Given the low amount of prebiotic fiber and the high amount of glucose, whole grains are probably not the best way of attaining your daily dose of fiber. Diversity rules. As I've mentioned, our immune systems benefit from a plurality of bacterial voices, and yet diversity is another area where our modern microbiomes are lacking. Many studies comparing the gut microbiomes of Western city dwellers to rural villagers and hunter-gatherers who eat more plants and thus more fiber have shown the striking loss of diversity driven by such modernization. By ensuring that your diet is rich in a mix of different types of fiber, as each type of fiber feeds different species of bacteria, you directly foster gut microbial diversity, a feature that researchers, even at this nascent state in microbiome study, agree is key to the health of the host. In fact, research has shown that fiber alone can dramatically increase or decrease gut microbial diversity, a quality that you might even be able to pass along to your kids. Here are some other ways to maximize your gut microbial diversity. Avoid antibacterial soaps and hand sanitizers. Use only when absolutely necessary, such as when visiting areas of high pathogen exposure risk, like hospitals. Embrace nature. Spend more time outdoors, in parks, camping, or hiking. Consume filtered water. The use of chlorine to eliminate outbreaks of waterborne pathogens in developing nations is a great thing, but many first world water supplies tend to be overtreated with chlorine. Shower less. Or use soap more sparingly, perhaps only every other shower. The resulting increase in mating scent molecules called pheromones may even help your dating life. Shampoo once or twice a week at most. There's no reason to shampoo every day. Buy organic produce whenever possible. Organic produce will be richer in antioxidant polyphenols, which support butyrate-producing bacteria as well as a healthy mucosa. Avoid taking broad-spectrum antibiotics unless absolutely necessary. Antibiotics can save lives when appropriate. This is an undeniable truth. However, 30% of antibiotics prescribed in the United States are completely unnecessary according to recent research, and they can devastate the microbial ecosystem. This can make room for opportunistic pathogens like C. difficile to take over instead. Adopt a pet. There are millions of homeless animals in shelters all around the United States that would be happy to help you increase your microbial diversity. Women who have a dog in their homes when pregnant are less likely to have children with allergies, and kids who grow up with dogs are 15% less likely to develop asthma. Living with a dog is one of the top ways to increase the microbial diversity of the home and in the gut. Slow down. Digestion takes place when you are relaxed, hence the term rest and digest. Eating on the go can set off a cascade of stress response mechanisms in the body that compromise digestion, not only impairing your absorption of nutrients, but affecting your bacterial friends' access to them as well. A bright future. The more we learn about the gut, the more we're coming to understand the role it may potentially play in the development of various diseases. At the same time, we're starting to see how tending to it might help treat those conditions as well. Many neurological and even psychiatric conditions are associated with intestinal inflammation and are preceded by symptoms in the gut. Autism spectrum disorder, or ASD, has been closely linked with gut inflammation, which coincides with inflammation in the brain. Many autistic children have intestinal problems such as inflammatory bowel disease and an excessively permeable gut lining. In a test of intestinal permeability called the lactulose-mannitol test, 37% of autism spectrum disorder children tested positive, compared to less than 5% of control group kids. That's a 7-fold increased incidence. This effect size certainly suggests a possible causal link, with either intestinal permeability causing autistic behavior, autism causing increased intestinal permeability, or some third factor, such as an environmental exposure, causing both. At the other end of the age spectrum, Parkinson's disease, a neurodegenerative condition, has also been strongly linked to gut health. One of the earliest and often overlooked signs of the disease is constipation. Though scientists are still working to understand this, a significant clue was revealed in a recent study involving 15,000 patients with severed vagus nerves. The vagus nerve sends messages from the GI tract directly to the brain, and only half of the patients with severed nerves developed Parkinson's disease over 20 years, compared to the rates seen in the general population. This is strong evidence that Parkinson's disease might in fact begin in the GI tract and travel up the vagus nerve to the brain. Fecal microbiota transplantation, the transplantation of healthy stool that is up to 60% bacteria by weight, is an exciting development because it provides an opportunity to press reset on the gut microbiome. Today, this procedure involves transplanting intact stool, which can contain thousands of types of bacteria. Scientists do not yet know exactly which ones hold the curative powers, but in the future, the potential for more selective bacterial interventions on a whole host of conditions will undoubtedly emerge. It's important to remember that the gut microbiota is but one element of our human microbial symbiosis. Emerging areas of research include the oral and sinus microbiomes. Poor oral health has been long linked to a number of systemic illnesses, including stroke, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and dementia. In a paper published in PLOS One, researchers found that patients with mild to moderate dementia with periodontitis, gum inflammation, had a 6-fold increase in the rate of cognitive decline 6 months later. Should we be swishing with antibiotic mouthwash, essentially nuking the friendlier bacteria populations in our oral microbiome along with those that may be more harmful? Do the same opportunistic species found in the gut lurk below the gum line, waiting for the right moment to stage a coup? These are questions that future research will undoubtedly need to address. The sinus or rhinosinal microbiome may be of particular relevance to the brain. The sinus cavity provides direct access to the brain via its rich vascular bed of highly permeable capillaries. What does this mean for the microbial chemical factory that inhabits that area? Recent research out of Harvard suggests that amyloid plaque, the kind that builds up in Alzheimer's disease, may be, for some, a response to a brain microbial infection. This positions the nasal microbiome as an exciting candidate for exploration in the coming years. What mixture of microbes provides the least competitive advantage for incoming troublemakers? Are probiotic nasal sprays a cognitive-boosting treatment of the future? Is it a coincidence that sense of smell is the first sense to be affected by cognitive decline? I, for one, am excited to track the developing science on the horizon. Field notes. A healthy gut becomes a butyrate factory, transforming dietary fiber to one of the most important quenchers of inflammation. Butyrate has been shown to boost BDNF, the brain's ultimate fertilizer. Autoimmunity, when the host's immune system attacks the cells of the host, can be instigated by gluten for many people. The typical low-fiber American diet, rich in emulsifiers, may exacerbate the threat posed by gluten. Gut bacterial diversity is important for training a healthy immune system, a feature modern life has greatly reduced. Genius food number 7, dark leafy greens. Vegetables are your brain's best friend. There are no ifs, ands, or buts about it, especially when we're talking about the non-starchy varieties including spinach and romaine lettuce, and the cruciferous veggies, cabbage, kale, mustard greens, arugula, and bok choy. These dark leafy greens are low in sugar and packed with vitamins, minerals, and other phytonutrients that the brain desperately needs to function properly. One of the nutrients that dark leafy greens are full of is the vitamin folate. In fact, the word folate comes from the Latin word for foliage, making it pretty easy to remember how to get more of it. Eat leaves. Known mostly for its ability to prevent neural tube birth defects, folate is an essential ingredient in your body's methylation cycle. This cycle occurs on a constant basis throughout the body and is critical for both detoxification and getting your genes to do their proper jobs. Another important nutrient found in greens is magnesium. Magnesium is known as a macro mineral because we need to get a relatively large amount of it from our food for optimal health and performance. Other macro minerals include sodium, potassium, and calcium. Nearly 300 enzymes rely on magnesium, making it pretty popular around the body. These enzymes are tasked with helping you generate energy and repairing damaged DNA, which is the underlying cause of cancer and aging, and even plays a role in Alzheimer's disease. Sadly, magnesium consumption is inadequate for 50% of the population. But lucky for us, anything green is usually a good source of magnesium, as this mineral is found at the center of the chlorophyll molecule, which gives plants their green pigmentation. Perhaps this is why a recent study has shown that people who ate just 2 servings of dark leafy greens a day had brains that looked 11 years younger on scans. Dark leafy greens also provide an undeniable benefit to us by way of the fiber that they contain. In Chapter 7, you learned all about the gut microbiome and its collective ability to produce short-chain fatty acids like butyrate, a powerful inflammation inhibitor. The number one way to feed these microbes and in turn extract butyrate for ourselves is to increase vegetable consumption, which ensures a diverse and ample pipeline of fermentable, prebiotic fibers for our microbe friends. Leafy greens even contain a newly discovered sulfur-bound sugar molecule called sulfoquinovose, try to say that 3 times fast, that directly feeds healthy gut bacteria. Overall, consumption of vegetables, and dark leafy greens in particular, benefits both brain and body and is inversely related to dementia risk and various biomarkers for aging. How to use. Eat one huge fatty salad daily, which is a salad filled with organic dark leafy greens like kale, arugula, romaine lettuce, or spinach, and doused with extra virgin olive oil. Avoid nutrient-poor varieties like iceberg lettuce, which is essentially just water and fiber. There will be more fatty salad options in the recipe section on the PDF enhancement. Chapter 8. Your Brain's Chemical Switchboard. My first attempt at decoding the word neurotransmitter and the many drugs that affect neurotransmission came during that crystalline moment immediately following my mom's diagnosis when we sat in the rental car in a parking lot outside the Cleveland Clinic. I was trying to sound out the drug names on the various pill bottles in our possession after our visit to the pharmacy. The brand names were bizarre clusters of vaguely word-like phonemes. Consonant, vowel, consonant, followed by vowel, consonant, vowel, combined in mellifluous, pleasing sequences. They looked like they could be words, should be words, as though one were reading the pages of a book written in English in a parallel dimension. Namenda. Cinemet. Aricept. How naturally they might slip into our daily conversations. Bro, what are you doing tonight? Namenda. Me neither. Let's go to the cinemet. I don't know if I accept that. The generic scientific names were obviously less tailor-made for a television audience, leaving an anxious ambiguity as I rolled them around on my tongue. Memantine. Levodopa. Carbidopa. Donepezil. Was that Donepezil or Donepezil? Where does the accent go, I wondered. I would settle on one pronunciation, fairly confident I had nailed it until a doctor would use a completely non-intuitive pronunciation. Wow, the things you learn in medical school. I would then go to another doctor's office, ready to impress him or her with my proper pronunciation, only to have that doctor smirk, confidently asserting that his third variant of Donepezil, everyone knows that first E is silent, is in fact the authoritative version. Pronunciation aside, what do these drugs actually do? These quirky-sounding compounds work by altering levels of neurotransmitters. Dementia drugs are not the only compounds that do this. Many prescription drugs, from antidepressants to ADHD medications to drugs that reduce anxiety, tinker with levels of these important chemical messengers. While these types of drugs are among the top-selling pharmaceuticals in the world, other compounds that humans have gravitated to across cultures also work similarly. Coffee, alcohol, cocaine, MDMA, and even sunlight all make us feel a certain way because of their impact on how neurotransmitters work. The notion that our brains don't work the way we want them to because of unbalanced levels of neurotransmitters has come to be known as the chemical imbalance theory. This theory is most commonly associated with depression, for which it states that feeling blue is caused by low levels of serotonin in your brain. But new research suggests that many common brain problems are not caused by deficits of neurotransmitters, but rather by neurotransmitters that are unable to work the way they ought to, due to an induced or underlying dysfunction. Similarly, dementia is not caused by low acetylcholine, a neurotransmitter involved in memory. Acetylcholine is low because the neurons that produce it are, in many cases, slowly dying. This is why such drugs have no disease-modifying ability, meaning they do nothing to solve the underlying problems that create the package of symptoms that we see as dementia. They act merely as band-aids. Attention deficits, memory loss, and depressed mood may all be manifestations of underlying problems, and pharmaceuticals continually come up short. How neurotransmitters work. For a microscopic system, neurotransmitter function is an incredibly elegant design. Some of the neurotransmitter gets released by a neuron. This neuron is called the presynaptic cell because it initiates the message and thus comes before the synapse. The neurotransmitter then moves into the synaptic cleft, which is the gap between neurons. There, molecules of neurotransmitter cross the gap to meet the receptor on the receiving or postsynaptic neuron. The leftover neurotransmitter is either taken back up by the presynaptic cell, called reuptake, or degraded by enzymes. Under normal conditions, this postsynaptic cleanup is done to prevent excessive stimulation of the postsynaptic cell. But in certain cases, it may be manipulated by drugs to various effect. For example, inhibiting reuptake is the mechanism by which certain antidepressant drugs increase availability of the neurotransmitter serotonin. Alternately, drugs that aim to boost acetylcholine in the brain, another important neurotransmitter, work by preventing its enzymatic degradation. This chapter will explore how to keep your neurotransmitters functioning optimally by helping you recreate the conditions that they were designed to work under. Whether you suffer from poor mood or memory, stress, or lack of focus, this section will help you to better understand how to maximize your quality of life, cognitive function, and brain health through the brain's main means of communication. Because a healthier brain enhances our experience of the world. It allows us to be the truest and most expressed versions of ourselves, capable of feeling, learning, loving, and connecting in ways that make life worth living. Glutamate, GABA, the yin and yang neurotransmitters. Ancient Chinese philosophy describes life in terms of the inhibitory, yin, and the excitatory, yang, coexisting in perfect harmony. Without knowing it, these ancient philosophers seem to have stumbled upon a rudimentary description of our two most fundamental neurotransmitters, thousands of years prior to the invention of the scientific method. GABA is the chief inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain, used in 30 to 40% of synapses brain-wide. Associated with a calming effect that has been dubbed nature's Valium, it works to counterbalance glutamate, the brain's chief excitatory neurotransmitter. The yang to GABA's yin. GABA and glutamate make up the brain's most plentiful neurotransmitters and are involved in the regulation of vigilance, anxiety, muscle tension, and memory functions. Glutamate. Used by more than half of all neurons, glutamate is GABA's precursor and increases the brain's overall level of excitation. Glutamate is normally involved in learning, memory, and synaptogenesis, the creation of new connections between neurons. We've already covered a few of biology's most famous double-edged swords, oxygen, insulin, and glucose, and glutamate is no different. Too much can cause excitotoxicity, harming nerve cells. Dysfunction of the complex mechanisms that govern glutamate release has been observed in Alzheimer's disease and is a destructive factor in ALS, a rapidly progressive neurological disease that attacks the neurons responsible for controlling voluntary movement. One of the two major classes of drugs used to treat dementia reduces glutamate-related excitotoxicity in the brain, and the only FDA-approved drug to extend life in ALS is also a glutamate-modulating agent. GABA. GABA inhibits the brain's overall level of excitation, and you're probably already familiar with how it feels to modulate it. Anti-anxiety drugs enhance the effect of GABA, as does alcohol. And both simultaneously inhibit glutamate. The problem is, these drugs are highly addictive and come with a host of consequences. The stimulating effects of caffeine, on the other hand, are owed to its ability to increase glutamate activity and inhibit GABA release. Anxiety, panic attacks, palpitations, and insomnia are all thought to manifest via dysfunction of the GABA system. The rise of the psychobiotic. Scientists studying depression in mice have to be clever in how they determine what constitutes depression, and one of the many interesting ways to gauge the overall life satisfaction of a mouse is called the forced swimming test. Here's how it works. Mice are dropped into a tank filled with water, where they immediately begin treading water until they find something to latch onto. Mice that are depressed tend to give up hope and allow themselves to sink sooner than happy mice who tread water for much longer. This is interpreted as an increased motivation to live. As strange as this sounds, it's actually how some antidepressants are initially studied and tested. In a unique twist on such an experiment, mice had their microbiomes populated with a certain type of probiotic called Lactobacillus rhamnosus, and then they were thrown into a tank. Compared to mice that didn't get the probiotic, those that did seemed more eager to stay afloat. They even showed a marked increase in anti-anxiety GABA receptors in certain parts of the brain. This effect was also absent in mice who were fed the probiotic, but had their vagus nerve severed. The vagus nerve innervates the intestines and is connected directly to the brain. This suggests that the mechanism of action was direct microbial communication with the brain. If probiotics helped depressed mice, what are the odds they might help with other psychiatric symptoms? Mice born to mothers that ate the mouse equivalent of fast food, a deadly combination of fat and sugar, multiple times a day, showed social behavior symptoms similar to autism. Upon inspection of their gut bacteria populations, these autistic mice had 9 times less of another probiotic species, Lactobacillus reitori, present. By restoring L. reitori with a probiotic supplement, scientists were able to correct these social behavioral deficits, and the mice even showed increased production of the social hormone oxytocin, which acts like a neurotransmitter in the brain. Interestingly, the amount of L. reitori found in our systems has declined in tandem with the increases seen in rates of autism and the consumption of fast food. In the 1960s, when the bacterium was discovered, L. reitori was present in 30 to 40% of the population. Today, it is found in 10 to 20%, a likely result of our diminished intake of fermented foods and fiber, our reliance on ultra-processed foods, and the rise in antibiotic use. Considering that L. reitori would normally be transmitted in breast milk, it's like the friend we didn't know we had until it was gone. Optimizing glutamate and GABA. One way of keeping this system functioning normally is to embody the glutamatergic, GABAergic balance in your own life, building in periods of deliberate excitation and inhibition. Intense exercise has been shown to promote balance, boosting both GABA and glutamate in the human brain. This effect lasts well beyond the workout, as it correlates with higher resting levels of glutamate 1 week later. Major depression is categorized as having reduced levels of both, and exercise has been shown to improve depressive symptoms. Exercise has also been shown to help the brain more effectively metabolize glutamate, thus reducing its buildup. Meditation, yoga, and deep breathing exercises are excellent ways of achieving increased GABA. Hypothermic conditioning, either by taking an ice bath or cold shower, or by doing cryotherapy, where one enters a tank filled with freezing nitrogen gas, usually for around 3 minutes, is an excellent means of normalizing one's GABA-glutamatergic balance. Though stressful and excitatory, thus stimulating the sympathetic fight-or-flight nervous response, people who participate in hypothermic conditioning will experience a significant drop in sympathetic activity and an increase in GABA after acclimation. Cold exposure also has the benefit of boosting another neurotransmitter involved in learning and attention called norepinephrine, which I'll discuss momentarily. Avoiding consumption of added glutamate in processed foods is another strategy for keeping this vital balance of our neurotransmitters. Monosodium glutamate, or MSG, a flavor enhancer often used in Chinese cooking, is one common source, and aspartame, a non-caloric diet sweetener, becomes excitatory, transforming into glutamate precursors once inside the body. Acetylcholine, the learning and memory neurotransmitter. Acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter that is part of the cholinergic system, which engages in many activities in the body but is mostly thought of for its role in REM sleep, learning, and memory. Low levels of acetylcholine are associated with Alzheimer's disease, where acetylcholine-producing neurons become damaged. In fact, the second of the two major classes of drugs currently used to treat Alzheimer's disease and other dementias works to increase acetylcholine availability in the brain by preventing its enzymatic breakdown at the synapse. I've already mentioned the first one, which modulates glutamate. Footnote. These drugs, called cholinesterase inhibitors, are not known for being particularly efficacious, in part because low acetylcholine is the result of underlying dysfunction, not the cause of it. These drugs do nothing to treat that dysfunction, and therefore do not alter disease progression. Optimizing acetylcholine. One way to ensure optimal acetylcholine function is to avoid a broad class of very common anticholinergic drugs. Many of these drugs are widely used and available over the counter, used to treat everything from allergies to insomnia. See the PDF for a list of drugs. These drugs, as the word suggests, block the neurotransmitter acetylcholine, and continuous use can cause cognitive problems in as little as 60 days. But even occasional use of a strong anticholinergic can cause acute toxicity. These symptoms are often remembered by med school students with the mnemonic blind as a bat, meaning dilated pupils, red as a beet, meaning flushing, hot as a hair, meaning fever, dry as a bone, meaning dry skin, mad as a hatter, meaning confusion and short-term memory loss, bloated as a toad, meaning urinary retention, and the heart runs alone, meaning rapid heartbeat. Neurotransmitters are more than just the messages they contain. Sometimes they are essential for keeping neurons healthy. Alarming research published in JAMA Neurology has shown that regular users of anticholinergic drugs had lower brain glucose metabolism and poorer cognitive abilities, including weaker short-term memory and executive function. Subjects even showed altered brain structures in MRI scans, displaying lower brain volume and larger ventricles, the cavities inside the brain. The anticholinergic drugs taken by these subjects included nighttime cold medicines, over-the-counter sleep aids, and muscle relaxants, all of which block acetylcholine. You might be wondering if chronic use of these drugs can increase risk of dementia, and the answer is yes. In a study of 3,500 older adults, University of Washington researchers found that people who used these drugs were more likely to have developed dementia than those who didn't use them. In fact, the more regular the usage, the greater the dementia risk. Taking an anticholinergic for the equivalent of 3 years or more was associated with a 54% higher dementia risk than taking the same dose for 3 months or less. If you take any of these drugs regularly, it is critical that you have a conversation with your physician about the possibility that they may be impairing your cognitive function and ultimately putting you at higher risk for dementia. If you're a carrier of the APOE4 allele described in Chapter 6, carriers make up 25% of the population, or have a strong family history of dementia, you and your doctor should definitely look for safer alternatives. Diet also factors into an optimal cholinergic system. Choline is the major dietary precursor to acetylcholine, and changes in plasma levels of choline lead to changes in brain levels of the precursors for this neurotransmitter. Choline is also a key component of cell membranes, which is where the body stockpiles it for later use. It's found in abundant quantities in seafood and poultry, but eggs may be the best source, with one large egg containing about 125 milligrams of choline in its yolk. Unfortunately, average choline intake in the United States is far below the adequate level, set at 550 milligrams per day for men and 425 milligrams per day for women, higher for those who are pregnant or breastfeeding, by the National Academy of Medicine. 10% or fewer had choline intakes at or above these levels. A list of top choline foods. Eggs. Eat your yolks. Beef liver. Shrimp. Scallops. Beef. Chicken. Fish. Brussels sprouts. Broccoli. Spinach. Vegans and vegetarians, you'd need to eat 2 full cups of broccoli or Brussels sprouts to get the same amount of choline as found in 1 single egg yolk. Serotonin, the mood neurotransmitter. Growing up in New York City, I would always feel my spirits drop come the fall. The impending winter months of long, dark days with little sun exposure gave rise to a kind of depression known as seasonal affective disorder, or SAD. Also known as winter depression, SAD affects an estimated 10 million people in the United States. And while the majority of those affected are women, everybody is at risk. When I was 17, I learned that the skin made vitamin D from exposure to the sun, and I realized that my lack of sun exposure during those dark months was likely compromising my body's vitamin D production. I had a hunch that my mood, the limited sun I was receiving, and the reduced vitamin D that I was synthesizing might all somehow be related. So I self-prescribed a vitamin D supplement to see if that would improve my mood. Lo and behold, I felt better. Was this a placebo effect? One can never be quite sure. A double-blind trial, this was not. However, nearly two decades since my experiment, scientists have discovered a mechanism that might very well explain the improvement I felt. It turns out that healthy serotonin levels may actually rely on vitamin D, as vitamin D helps to create serotonin from its precursor, the amino acid tryptophan. This is an important insight, particularly in light of research estimating a vitamin D deficiency in 3/4 of the U.S. population. Serotonin is well known for its mood and sleep-boosting abilities, and it makes up the basis of what is called the serotonergic system. You may be familiar with the class of antidepressant drugs on the market called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs. These drugs promise to boost serotonin's availability at the synapse by preventing its reuptake into the presynaptic cell. Again, prescription drugs aren't the only compounds that tinker with this neurotransmitter. The drug MDMA is known for its mood-altering influence, attributed to its effect on the serotonergic system. Initially studied for its potential to treat post-traumatic stress and other treatment-resistant mental disorders, MDMA is like dynamite to the dam governing normal serotonin release. But the act of releasing huge amounts of serotonin overwhelms the recycling machinery and causes oxidation of the surrounding neurons, literally burning them away. Perhaps this is why chronic, long-term MDMA use has been linked with memory problems and brain damage. A recurring theme in this book is that every biologic action has an equal and opposite reaction. There's no such thing as a biological free lunch. Another compound, psilocybin, the psychoactive chemical in magic mushrooms, prevents serotonin reuptake and also mimics serotonin, activating its receptors. This is unlike MDMA, which floods the synapses with your own serotonin. For this reason, psilocybin may have fewer negative long-term effects. In groundbreaking research performed by both New York University and Johns Hopkins University, psilocybin was shown to alleviate anxiety and increase feelings of life satisfaction in patients with life-threatening cancer for 6 months after just a single dose. The cognitive enhancing potential of low doses of psilocybin, called microdosing, is currently being studied. Serotonin isn't just for good vibes. It's also heavily involved in executive function. We know this because scientists have devised a clever way of temporarily reducing levels of serotonin in people, and the results aren't pretty. As I've mentioned, serotonin is synthesized in the brain from the essential amino acid tryptophan. The tryptophan we consume in protein makes its way up to the brain, where it then has to be carried across the blood-brain barrier by transporters. Other amino acids vie for these same transporters, including branched-chain amino acids, which are important for brain function and muscle growth, among other things. When given as a standalone supplement, these amino acids can outcompete tryptophan, blocking its entry into the brain. One of the ways exercise actually boosts your mood is by causing your muscles to suck up circulating branched-chain amino acids, thus allowing tryptophan easier entry into the brain. More on this in a moment. So what happened when scientists gave these amino acids to subjects? Serotonin levels temporarily plummeted. This was accompanied by a wide range of behavioral changes, including increased aggression, impaired learning and memory, poorer impulse control, a reduced ability to resist short-term gratification, impaired long-term planning, and reduced altruism. It's easy to see how these traits might reinforce feelings of depression and even contribute to violent tendencies. As a fascinating aside, bright light exposure during such a treatment seems to attenuate some of these effects, suggesting yet another method of ensuring healthy serotonin expression, daily sunlight exposure. Optimizing serotonin. By this point, you're starting to understand how to keep inflammation in your body to a minimum, avoiding sugars, grains, and oxidized oils while consuming ample plant nutrients and fiber. We'll cover more in the following chapters before we put it all together in the plan. If you've already begun integrating these ideas into your lifestyle, you're on your way to optimizing your serotonin expression. This is because inflammation may block serotonin from being released by your neurons, as was shown in research from Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute, or CHORI. This perhaps explains why depression caused by chronic inflammation is resistant to traditional therapy methods, but can be treated by reducing inflammation in the body. The CORI researchers found that the anti-inflammatory omega-3 fatty acid EPA facilitated normal serotonin release, while DHA, which supports membrane fluidity, discussed in Chapter 2, promoted healthy uptake into the postsynaptic cell. As SSRI cells continue to skyrocket, this type of research is increasingly important, providing strong evidence that low serotonin may be the result of an underlying problem for many people, rather than the cause of depression itself. This kind of insight is sorely needed, especially considering that 1 in 10 Americans now takes an antidepressant medication. Among women in their 40s and 50s, the figure is 1 in 4. And are they effective? A recent JAMA meta-analysis concluded, the magnitude of benefit of antidepressant medication compared with placebo increases with severity of depression symptoms and may be minimal or non-existent on average in patients with mild or moderate symptoms. For patients with very severe depression, the benefit of medications over placebo is substantial. In other words, for a lot of people, antidepressants are no better than a placebo, with the exception being the most severe cases of depression. And even then, non-pharmacologic treatments have shown impressive successes, like the recently published SMILES trial, as well as experiments involving anti-inflammatory compounds such as curcumin, a component of the spice turmeric. Can diet really treat depression? The SMILES trial. The link between depression and poor diet is well established, and being depressed can certainly lead us to unhealthy eating. But do poor diets make us depressed? And if we improve our diets, will our mental health improve? We now have an answer thanks to the SMILES trial published in 2017 and led by Dr. Felice Jacka, the director of Deakin University's Food and Mood Center in Australia. Using a modified Mediterranean diet focusing on fresh vegetables, fruits, raw unsalted nuts, eggs, olive oil, fish, and grass-fed beef, Jacka and team saw patients with major depression improve their scores by an average of about 11 points on a 60-point depression scale. By the end of the trial, 32% of patients had scores so low that they no longer met the criteria for depression. Meanwhile, people in the group with no dietary modification improved by only about 4 points, and only 8% achieved remission. This data adds serious strength to the argument that we can eat our way to a better mood, and the Genius Plan has been calibrated to incorporate these findings. To watch an hour-long, in-depth interview that I conducted with Dr. Jacka, visit maxl.ug/Felice Jacka interview. Aside from sunlight, vitamin D, and omega-3 fatty acids, DHA and EPA, what other magic supplement might you take to boost serotonin? Given the body's incredible ability to synthesize neurotransmitters from the most basic of building blocks, the most potent means we know of boosting serotonin in the brain is to simply move. As I mentioned earlier, exercise boosts plasma tryptophan. Remember, this is serotonin's precursor, and decreases levels of the branched chain amino acids, which, though important, compete with tryptophan for entry into the brain. This substantial boost in tryptophan's availability to the brain persists even after the workout is finished. In another powerful and illuminating head-to-head study, no SSRI was as effective as exercise 3 times per week in combating depression. That's game, set, match. There's another means of boosting serotonin in the brain that you may already be familiar with, and that is with carbohydrates and sugar. This temporary mood boost is behind one of the more addictive qualities of carbohydrates. And then, when carbohydrate levels curtail in between meals, serotonin drops, sending us reaching for something starchy or sugary, demonstrating why carbohydrate consumption is not a sound strategy for increasing serotonin. In pivotal psychological studies, feeding sugar to subjects has been shown to temporarily improve willpower and executive function. But it's hard to tease out whether the sugar actually boosts function or simply treats withdrawal from the lack of it. It would help to see these studies replicated on fat-adapted subjects. Regardless, though, short-circuiting the reward systems of the brain with external stimuli, whether with sugar, drugs, sex, or chronic bouts of extended and high-intensity cardio, rarely leads anywhere positive in the long term. But sugar in particular keeps you on an insulin roller coaster throughout the day, can cause you to gain weight, and can lead to metabolic dysfunction, reinforcing many of the inflammatory mechanisms making you depressed to begin with. Serotonin in the gut. According to an oft-cited statistic, 90% of the body's supply of serotonin is found in the gut, not the brain,